Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
And we're so glad that you're back with us today. Today, we are talking about The Handmaid's Tale, Season 3, Episode 1, entitled Night.
And it's all in preparation for what is coming, well, soon, as of this moment.
Right.
But it's coming. It will be here. Episode 1, Season 4.
And I'm so excited. I've seen a couple of interviews that Elizabeth Moss has given about Season 4. Ooh. Like as promotion for Season 4. Then I saw the trailer, a new trailer for Season Ooh. 4. A different one than the one I had seen, which shows June not in Gilead.
Okay.
She's wearing lipstick and her hair is visible.
I did. I saw something like that. And I was like, oh man, that's hard because it could be a flashback. But does it look like a flashback? It could be. But it's really, really tempting.
I was vibrating because I've read the testaments and actually did an episode of the show on the testaments while you were out of town. Yes. Unexpectedly. I really would like to see the show start moving in that direction.
Oh, good.
Because I think there's really, really good, interesting stuff that I know is coming.
Yeah.
If they're, and I think they're going to kind, they've stayed pretty true. They've done some changes when it came to the show from things from the original work, because they're really, the original book only covered the first season.
Right. I was about to ask again, just to make sure I knew this. But Season 2 is a continuation of the story.
Right.
But they stayed pretty true to the spirit of it.
They did. And it was very interesting. And Margaret Atwood gave it her blessing. I think she consulted or they talked with her some about kind of the direction of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so having read the testaments, then seeing that promotional video for Season 4 gives me a lot of hope that they're going to kind of try and move into the testaments as far as how they're going to end up ultimately.
Ooh, I'm so excited to find out.
I'm so excited
too. Now, I didn't get to read the testaments because, like you said, I was whisked away out of town. It was kind of a thing. And so I didn't get to read it, but I really can't wait to go read it. And now I'm thinking maybe I wait to read it until after Season 4. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, well, because I don't think Season 4 is the end. They're not going to get to the testaments.
Aha. Okay. Gotcha. So
at one point, they said they'd like 10 seasons of The Handmaid's Tale. So it may be quite some time before they get there.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But from what I've seen, they're kind of headed in that direction. I'm vibrating because I love the testament. Some people didn't like it, but I've been a fan of The Handmaid's Tale since I read it in the 90s.
Right.
And have loved it and was horrified by it all in equal measure because it's horrifying. Mm-hmm. But
Well, that's what we do here.
Yeah.
We completely enjoy things we're horrified by.
Exactly.
Welcome to Killer Fun.
For sure. So the patriarchal theocratic society of Gilead is still encompassing the eastern and much of the Midwest of the U.S. And unfortunately for the characters in the show, the potential escape of a handmaid and an infant didn't instantly bring down the demise of this violent, backwards society. It's good for us, bad for them. But it kind of sparked a fire in June, and this is where the premiere of Season 3 kind of picks right up. They're very good about picking right up where they left off.
They did a great job.
They've done this every season. They pick right back up. So it's super good. So we have a couple of new faces in this episode. They may have appeared in Season 2, but we haven't talked about them yet. And they're kind of, well, one is really important. Bradley Whitford is Commander Joseph Lawrence. He was in Transparent, The West Wing, Cabin in the Woods, lots of other stuff. Amy Landecker is Mrs. McKenzie, who is the mother, the new mother to June's child.
All right.
That was taken from her
mother. Yeah. Well, we can't really do air quotes on an audio show, but air quotes, mother.
She was also in Transparent, Doctor Strange, Sneaky Pete, which is great. I love Sneaky Pete.
That is such a good show.
All right. So shall we recap it?
Yes. Let's recap.
All right. So Commander Lawrence, who helped his handmaid Emily and June's baby Nicole get a ride to Canada, picks up June. And he's exasperated and intrigued in equal measure that she did not also get on the transport to Canada. June sneaks an illicit visit with her daughter, Hannah, the one who was stolen from her at the inception of Gilead. Hannah is now called Agnes, and she sleeps through June's entire visit and then is apprehended. But before they take her away, Mrs. McKenzie very kindly shares a little information about Hannah and how loved she is, how she's thriving, what her interests are. And she begs June with the heart of a mother to stop trying to visit the child because it gives her nightmares and confuses her. Which I'm like,
I have so many thoughts, so many words, so many opinions about this moment. And it's such a complex moment. And like, I think that if you're not a mother, I think you can still get into that scene and understand how weirdly complex that was. Like, an ethics course could be taught on that scene, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm interrupting. I'm interrupting the recap. No. We will do this later.
So Emily and baby Nicole have a perilous escape across the river to Canada, and they're taken to a hospital after asking for asylum. June is returned to a very contentious Waterford home. Serena Joy has told Fred, her husband, Commander Waterford, that she was complicit in baby Nicole's escape, and he's very angry and very afraid and does not know what is going to happen next. So they come up with a plausible kidnapping story, which protects Serena and June by extension. But Serena Joy ends up burning down the house.
Yeah.
Starting with the master bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Serena goes to stay with family. Commander Waterford goes to stay wherever, quarters. And June is sent to the re-education center, the Red Center, which is where they train, quote unquote, handmaids.
Yeah.
Yeah. June is tortured there for going to see Hannah. But since the Waterfords no longer have a home, June has to be reassigned. So she goes to live at a home where she's been requested.
Requested.
That's right. Commander Lawrence, Emily's commander, who helped Emily and baby Nicole escape.
Enter of Joseph.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh.
This is, I mean, really, ethics courses could be taught on at least, I could pick up 5 scenes in this episode that you could literally teach an ethics course about. I mean, the complexities of the mother situation, right? Of stop visiting your child because it gives her nightmares and I'm her mother. And you're kind of like, but you are the perpetrator of this injustice. How is it me, right? That is making her confused. And it's like this idea of how much do you fight the whole system versus how much do you fight to rescue the individual in a situation and all of the chaos that ensues there. And this is everything that June is dealing with.
Right.
And it's just, ugh.
Well, and the way she talks to Serena about the absence of baby Nicole.
Oh, gosh.
Is it really in the same vein? And that lasts throughout the entire season about how these women can love these children so intently, whether or not they have a biological connection to them, and so completely differently.
Well, and it is the biological thing. I mean, there is that fight. And I think that probably that exists to some extent today across the world, less so in the United States, not because we don't have adoption in sorts, but in other countries, families can give up a child to an orphanage. mm-hmm. because they can't take care of them, but retain legal rights.
Right.
And so when the child is you know, tried to be adopted out, then the parents can come back and say, no, no, no. And then all of a sudden you really do have two families fighting over a child. And this does happen. But in this case, it's not a matter of adoption. Hannah wasn't given up.
No.
She was stolen, kidnapped. Yeah. She was trafficked as a commodity. And these, quote, mothers are the slave masters of their trafficked child. And trying to make June think, but I'm her mother and I love her just the same. And you're kind of like, I don't know that you get to love her, quote, just the same.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are complicit in this trafficking of the children.
Right.
And yet, on the other hand...
But at the same time, the wives are just as much slaves.
Exactly!
They're like a higher level of slave.
Exactly! So, and they're trying their best to actually give a good life. And what would happen to Hannah if she wasn't adopted? So, she's... Oh.
I know. The layers of it.
But... When June tells Serena Joy about how Hannah was ripped out of her hands and taken away, and now she is supposed to be safe somewhere, and I hope this feels like that, I was like, oh, speechless. And I've seen it before.
Yes, but I hadn't watched it since it came out, like in 2019.
Yeah.
And so watching it again, and I think I will have to say, I got sucked in and binge watched the entire third season, which I absolutely knew was going to happen.
Of course.
So I just kind of went with it.
Of course.
And I think I prefer this show as a binge watch.
I do too. And I got to binge watch it.
Yeah.
When I first viewed it.
Yeah.
And so I really did appreciate that. And having to wait at all
is going to be tough.
Like, hard.
Yeah. Well, because I think you're left with so many questions at the end of every episode and frustration at having those questions, to know that you can start the next one right away and kind of see the forward movement without having to wait for it.
Yeah.
That said, I'm not going to wait for all of season four to be out before I watch it.
No, I think I'm just going to have to dive in.
But let me tell you, it's a more frustrating experience.
Sometimes, I don't know about you, but sometimes with this show, I'll literally have to pause it and then have like a whole conversation with myself about the ethics,
and what just happened.
Yeah, like I just have to like think about all this stuff and then I can continue on. So maybe that's where I'll have to be at the end of each episode as I wait for the next one to come out. I'll have to like just go into that mode then, like. Save it for the end, Jackie. You've got like a week to go. However much time. So, because there was moments where this one I just had to pause because I was bawling again.
And you know what's going to happen and still you're bawling.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's moments.
Generally, the critics really liked this season, but the audience reviews were kind of mixed, which I thought was interesting.
Interesting.
So, I'd say most reviewers were pretty excited about it. Vern gave Newsday, if not much sunnier, not as relentlessly grim as the second season, while June is slowly, methodically morphing into the robo June we must know she needs to become.
That's
good.
Mm-hmm.
Sophie Gilbert from The Atlantic didn't like it. She said June is trapped in her sequence of shock, rebellion, rinse, and repeat. She doesn't feel like a person anymore. Which I'm like, aren't you supposed to understand that that's what this relentless society is doing to you?
Yeah, that's exactly what she's fighting.
Right, exactly. She's fighting. She has to kind of absorb the qualities of this really horrific society to be able to fight against it.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, begs the question, do you, when you're fighting injustice, do you become the injustice?
At what point does that turn?
And you have to be careful.
You have to be careful. Yeah. And sometimes I don't even think it's a matter of like an ethical tipping point. Sometimes it's a matter of you become too tired to continue the resistance from inside. And so thereby your actions are no longer as effective and therefore you need to get out because now you really are perpetuating the problem and not providing enough resistance or enough solutions because you're just not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like sometimes you got to be benched, put somebody else in for a while.
Right.
Right. So.
And then sometimes there is no bench. You just have to keep going.
You just have to keep going.
Yeah. I felt this way. Jasper Reeves of the Daily Telegraph said, I may be too in love with the slow burn of the visual storytelling, but The Handmaid's Tale still knows what it's about. And then Michael Cooper of LA Weekly disagreed, and I disagree with him. He said, The Handmaid's Tale seems to be going too slowly, stretching out the story to fill the latest season. And I can see how it felt like that when it was on.
Yeah, that's true.
But when you binge it, it's, you kind of forgive some of the frustrating parts of it.
Well, and I keep going back to this idea of there's a lot of heady intellectual stuff. Usually I don't like slow burn cinematic choices.
Yeah, that's usually like, your husband's thing.
Yeah, and he hates this show and I love it. I say hates. We have to go back to that. Well, that he doesn't really hate it, but he's conflicted. But yeah, and that's the difference. But I think it is related to the idea of I can get lost in those moments with all the things I'm thinking through, the ethics and all the stuff that it's brought up. And so I can go there. Whereas a lot of times with other slow burns, you're really supposed to be staying more in this very singular moment.
Right.
Whereas this one allows the moments
to become broader
and complex, mm-hmm. and allows me to think about it while I'm seeing her in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a little different, but not really. And so it is very weird that I love the slow burn.
Yes.
In this
and when
one.
We talked a little bit about you and your husband having conflicted emotions about this last time, but most of that got cut out. So you'll hear that this summer when we have our outtakes episode.
Yes.
You'll get to hear a lot more of what we talked about.
Right. Yeah. Some bonus material there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So look forward to that. There's no reason to skip those episodes. It's all new material. It's great.
It's all new and it's fantastic. And mm-hmm. we go through some fantastic rabbit trails.
Oh, yes, we do. Then there were some audience reviews. Every episode was good. It's so creepy, but in the best way possible. And then there's this one.
Uh-oh.
He didn't like it.
Okay.
This is for seasons 1-3. Interesting premise, but extremely slow pace. Overall, I'm not a big fan, but the wife likes it, so I watch.
All right. Can we do a very unscientific survey?
Uh-huh.
Of the people who liked it, how many were women?
Most of them.
How many men liked it versus women?
Fewer.
Far fewer.
Yeah. So that actually brings me to Statista.com.
Ooh.
Did a survey of people who've watched The Handmaid's Tale. Now, this is from 2018.
I love how you think, you know what I'm going to think about. Uh-huh. You pull it right out. That's awesome.
Well, because I was thinking about it, especially after you and I had talked about how, you know, your husband was, he wants to like it, but doesn't.
Right.
Yeah. My husband's sort of the same.
Yeah.
Like, I'll watch it with you. He's like, I never feel good at the end of it. I'm like, well, you're not really supposed to. It's not like a feel-good story. It's supposed to make you think about things.
Yeah.
I digress. So they, in May of 2018, they found that the hardcore audience,
mm-hmm.
who've seen every episode or watched it weekly, it was almost twice as many women as it was men among the people that they surveyed. 11% of women and 6% of men.
Wow.
Had seen every episode or watched it weekly when it came out. What's interesting is that when you combined every episode, sometimes, and rarely, the percentages are more men. 24% of the men that they talked to had seen at least rarely. So they've at least seen one episode. For women, it was only 19%. So of the hardcore people, it was mostly women.
Mm-hmm.
But men were more likely to check out at least one episode than women were.
Well, because if you're a woman and you like it and you watch one, you watch them all.
Right.
This is how this works.
Well, and if
it's like Pringles.
If you're a woman and it's not interesting to you, like you watch the promo for it or whatever, and you don't
You just won't check it out.
You just won't bother to check it out at all.
This is my hypothesis about why this stacks up that way. As I think if you're a woman and you watch it, you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I was to extrapolate from the data, which that's a little hard because there's not a whole lot here.
No.
However, if just hearing that, my questions would be, you know, is it because that women get roped in so they don't ever just watch rarely or sometimes? If they're watching, they're watching all the way.
Right.
And then how many of these men watched because their wives told them to watch and that's how they ended up with us sometimes or rarely.
Right.
Right. Like these are the questions, but the data asks those questions, which kind of tells you what direction we're going.
Yeah. It's you know? Interesting. I thought it was a little surprising, and people of men, 74% of the respondents to the survey had never seen it, but 77% of women had never seen it. So it was like, that's interesting. Like, it's really like if a woman is interested in it, she's going to watch it and probably watch all of it.
It does seem that way. It is hard because this isn't just, it's not like on network television, right? So you do have this confound of who are you asking this question to? Do they have access to Hulu particularly?
Right.
Because you have to pay specifically for that. It's right. Not free.
Right.
Whereas, you know, with a network show,
right,
your stats may look a lot different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But
they couldn't put this on network television. It would have to be premium cable of some kind.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It would have to be. So
yeah.
It was a good decision.
Yeah.
Because to water it down would have been like, no.
Yeah.
No.
Allison Shoemaker of AV Club thought that the first episode of season 3 kind of hit a reset button, which I thought was an interesting way to look at it. She was frustrated by the fact that they put June back in the same house where, you know, a baby has gone missing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of death surrounding June in a lot of ways, but they keep putting her back in the same place, which I understand her frustration as a reviewer with that. But I was thinking about it, and I think that it's very indicative and tells you something about the way Gilead operates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That even if people know that Waterford's telling a lie, taking June away from him is saying, we don't believe you. And he is too powerful a man for them to not believe him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this dance that they have to play in Gilead of illusion and secrecy and deceit that you have to play in order to survive.
Well, yeah. I mean, the wall is full all the time, so they're not the only house with this crap going down.
Right.
This is just one story.
This is just one.
This is why it's called The Handmaid's Tale, not really the story of June.
Right.
Because it is the every handmaid's tale.
Right.
It's not like her odd, exceptional experience in this wonderful new place called Gilead.
Mm-hmm.
It is the salient, representative example of what's happening across Gilead.
Yeah.
So if you could put her somewhere else, it's still going to be crap going down.
Mm-hmm.
That wall is always full, y'all.
Exactly. Shoemaker says, the destruction of the Waterford house feels less like a major change and more like hitting a reset button, which I thought was fair.
I do like that. Yeah, that's, I think, a fair assessment, too.
The umbrage that she took with this episode was, you can't just decide to make something like this happen in regards to June's decision that she's going to bring down Gilead. Like, she's going to stay and fight. She's going to fight for her daughter. She's going to fight for other children. She's made this, like,
decision. Yeah,
this decision in her heart. The soundest of plans can go awry, and when there's no plan at all beyond fighting back, the odds aren't such great an effort will be successful. The fight might be blessed, but it's not automatic.
Yeah.
Which I can see that. Like, mm-hmm. She's made this decision, but she has no plan.
No plan.
At all.
Sometimes that's how it works, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about Serena Joy and all of the Is It True Psychology Break real life stuff right after this quick break.
Do you like meat? Cutting, cooking, and enjoying? Are you sure you know the difference between a hanger steak and a skirt steak, but don't feel like Googling it? Then show up to the wrong place at the right time for a change. The Red, White, and Foods Podcast. recorded in the Days of Our Knives meat shop with your host, the One True Butcher. The Red, White, and Foods podcast is a protein-powered, meat-fueled ride-through food and culture, bringing the barbecue back to the neighborhood. New episodes every Monday, available on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to your podcast. The Red, White, and Food podcast, where our motto is, cut it, cook it, enjoy it. Any way you slice it, meat is money.
So here's how it works. Christy wrecks her search history. Hey, NSA, we promise it's nothing more nefarious than a podcast. To find out what's true, some of the psychological motivations behind the character's actions, and real-life applications that relate to our topic. I have no idea what Christy decided to look up. Could be the same thing that captured my curiosity or something I never thought of.
All right, is it true? So, Serena and the Laws of Gilead.
Oh, yes. Let's please talk about
just a couple of things that I really noted. And of course, she's smoked the entire series. She smoked in the book. But I had to look it up in their little wiki, in the Handmaid's Tale wiki. And it is absolutely contraband for everyone, not just women, to have cigarettes. But if you're rich, you can have alcohol and cigarette and
whatever you want.
And whatever you want. Right.
Because that's how it goes.
Mm-hmm. And then Serena is based on a couple of real people.
Oh, whoa, really?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, Serena Joy, I love this name, though. Yeah. I would never name anybody Serena Joy because, well, you know, the book.
Yeah.
But it's so pretty.
It is. Serena's a really pretty name. And actually, I wasn't going to mention that from the wiki, but I will. Serena Joy is a lovely name, mm-hmm. and it's not one that she was given. Her real name is Pam.
Oh, whoa, really?
Serena Joy is her stage name.
Oh, interesting.
Because.
Well, it is a pretty stage name.
Uh-huh. In this article, Sarah Jones wrote it for The New Republic. The Handmaid's Tale is a warning to conservative women.
Uh-huh.
She tells us that Atwood based Serena Joy on an amalgam of Phyllis Schlafly and Tammy Faye Baker.
Oh, that's going to ruin my eyeliner.
I mean, spot on, right?
What can you do but laugh?
The spectacle of female fundamentalist celebrity is not recent, and she is not an anomaly. Her existence is proof of American fundamentalism's durability and a reminder that could not thrive without the enthusiastic backing of women.
It's true. So in the book, she takes on the stage name Serena Joy to author the work that she publishes.
In the book, she's not an author. She's a speaker.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In the show, she's an author and a speaker.
Right.
She's she was a gospel singer and a speaker.
Okay.
In the book.
Gotcha.
Whereas when we meet Serena Joy, she's a quote unquote homemaker because that's the only role she could really have. But Schlafly was no homemaker. She traveled the country. She appeared on television. She influenced policy. The world she wanted to build could not coexist with the world that had allowed her career.
Isn't that weird? Doesn't that bother you on so many levels?
Like a million?
How do you not see this coming?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
if you're her, right?
Right. Well, exactly. So the dilemma of Serena Joy feels deceptively easy to resolve. She's in this for power and understands that it's hers if she says the right things to the right audiences. With Gilead, however, Atwood reminds such women that they might not like the results of their labor. So later in this season, we see Serena Joy lament how frustrated she is that she can't have the job that she once had, which was writing books and being a speaker and influencing and for what she thought was really a good cause.
Right.
I disagree. I believe feminism gives us choices, gives all people choices, not just women.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's a response to fear. I mean, like, okay, so I have not read the book, so I'm the show only, but I do remember that when they sort of reveal her story, you sort of learn that she is fueled by the fear of the birth rate that's falling. Mm-hmm. And that life issue above all has become such a blinding issue that instead of putting it in context of things of like ethics and principles and, you know, integrity and basic human respect and dignity, she has one singular goal, and that is to change the course of what she sees as the damning sin of society, which is the falling birth rate caused by infertility and then caused by people's wrong actions that have, you know,
mm-hmm. Well, it's
sending
looking
it all hell to Alabaska.
It's right? Saying that it's individual people who are responsible for the falling birth rate, that everyone as an individual is responsible for that, and absolutely ignoring all of the environmental, global, society-wide factors that are a cause
right.
of that.
Because when you advocate for the justice, obviously it's people individually who have to make a difference collectively, but mm-hmm. if you ignore the culture, the systemic issues, the policy issues, and the confirmation bias that exists among them, then you're acting, you're actually... You're asking individuals to make up for the deficit of what a people did. And that's where you need people to have policy changes and things of that sort. You're not going to change the birth rate by blaming women and making them stay home and cook. That right. doesn't fix infertility.
No.
But if you blame it on their sins and make it an individual thing, and then you force them to do that, well, then you feel like you've made a difference, even though you really haven't.
Right.
Exactly. Hence the power.
Exactly. Exactly.
But I think she also always thought that she would remain above everybody else.
Well.
She was special, and the rules wouldn't apply to her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, that's how
she learned that real fast by losing a pinky, didn't
that's
she?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. This was a really interesting bit near the conclusion of this article. But The Handmaid's Tale does more than present a possible future. It asks us to consider how we end up there, a form of feminism that celebrates power for power's sake instead of interrogating how it's concentrated and distributed will usher us into fascism.
Yes.
And I'm like,
boy,
spot on.
Nail meat head.
So when we first talked about The Handmaid's Tale, all the way back in June of 2018, when we talked about the very first episode, we learned that Nolite te bastardes carborundum, the phrase that was carved inside the closet in season one and is scrawled boldly above June's bed in the Waterford house in this first episode was kind of like a false Latin. But I didn't realize that has kind of an interesting backstory.
Interesting.
So, nolite means don't, literally in Latin, and te means you. Bastardes is just like a Latinized version of the word bastard. And then carborundum is actually the brand name of a abrasive cleaner from like 120 years ago.
Oh, okay.
It's no longer around.
Okay.
But it kind of sounds Latinish.
Okay.
And it was a joke between Margaret Atwood and her classmates.
Okay.
And I guess it was a fairly common joke in Canada where they would make these Latin sort of sounding phrases, and this was one.
And that's how they kind of described it initially when she asks what it means and he was like, "You don't get it."
Uh-huh.
Like it's kind of a joke. Remember in the
yeah.
early season, they mm-hmm. kind of hint at it, but they never explain it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny. It was carborundum. It's basically Ajax.
Yes, exactly. It is basically Ajax.
Okay.
And then I didn't see this when we've talked about this in the past, but at Comic-Con in 2017, right before this show first debuted, they did this really awesome marketing campaign where they went into the ladies' restrooms and they put that phrase nolite te bastardes carborundum on the inside of stalls like graffiti.
Okay.
And they didn't put what it was about. They just put on the mirror a QR code, a sticker with a QR code that says please report vandalism and violations.
Oh, hilarious.
And the only way you know it's part of The Handmaid's Tale was in tiny little print, they had a little hashtag, Handmaids on Hulu. I'm like, that's genius.
How awesome is that?
It's genius. It was so good.
Oh, I'm going to have to like note this down. Like, I got ideas. No. We should do that. Okay. All right.
So Emily and Nicole's escape to Canada was really intentionally filmed. And the showrunners worked with the UN to try and tell a story that was accurate and representative of a really wide swath of refugees, so that it was very, not just relatable, but it helps you understand the plight of a lot of refugees. So, yes. Yeah.
I bawled.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I bawled so hard.
Which is funny because you're not a crier.
I'm not a crier.
No.
But I was in all a hot mess with this. The scene particularly at the end when she finally gets across the river.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy comes up to her and she like holds the baby and she's like, no, no, no. Like she's so, and he goes, oh, see, I'm going to cry just thinking about it. Something about the way that he just so directly says, if you are returned to your home country, will you face, and he rattles off these things.
Persecution based on your gender. Yeah.
And would you, and then he pauses and she's like, what's happening? And he goes, do you seek asylum? And I was like, oh God, like just the plight of so many people to cross the river and to be asked, not put in handcuffs.
Right.
Well, do you seek asylum? Because they trusted their story.
Right.
They trusted their story that was happening to them because it was right across.
Yeah.
And I started to cry because of all the people who have to make it even so much further.
Yeah.
Who have to make it so much further, who risk so much more. And instead of being asked, do you seek asylum?
Yeah, they put them in prison.
It's just awful. And I just cried because in that moment, of course, I'm like all wrapped up into the show and I'm like, she's made it.
Rory made it.
Yes. You know, and I'm like, oh, and then just, but the way that they handled that and the way that they did that and the way that they threw the Mylar blanket over her. And that was her first sign that like,
oh this everything's is like normal.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I looked up some information about women refugees and migrants on the United Nations website. It's interesting. They have a whole section called unwomen.org. And I'm like, well, that just makes like perfect sense that I'd be looking this up for The Handmaid's Tale, because they don't talk about it much in the show, at least not once you get to like season 3. But women who are in the colonies, which is like the concentration work camp kind of place, and it's very dangerous and awful, they're called unwomen. And so the website is unwomen.org, unwomen. I was like, holy moly.
Oh, that's funny.
Uh-huh. So, interesting. Women are about half of the 244 million migrants. And they are fully half of the 19.6 million refugees worldwide. So when you add in children, most refugees are women and children. They have very high labor market participation rates. That 72.7% of migrant women are in the workforce as compared to 63.9% of non-migrants. So they want to go and they want to work. 50% of the world's refugees are women and girls, and yet only 4% of projects in the UN interagency appeals where they ask for money are targeted at women's and girls' situations. That it's a very small amount, which is a little frustrating, and it seems like they're kind of acknowledging that here. 60% of preventable maternal deaths take place in humanitarian settings.
Oh, I believe that. I mean, it makes sense.
And 20% of all refugees or displaced women experience sexual violence. Mm-hmm. So they're suggesting that within the UN and other organizations, that placing women in decision-making roles and including their needs in initiatives is going to really improve the lives of everybody who is a refugee.
Well, thank you. Notorious RBG said it. Wherever decisions are made, women should be there. Women need to be there.
Well, when you help women, you help families.
You do.
When you help men, you can help families. But when you help women, you always help family because they always help their children. They help their spouse. Mm-hmm. They pull everybody out.
I just don't know how you actively ignore half the population. Half.
I mean, and the half that ends up bringing in more. I mean, like, you can't have more people unless you have women.
Yeah, really. And I mean, I get the truth is you can't have more without the men too.
Well, right.
Technically.
Yeah.
However, how do you just ignore half of the people? Well, I just don't get this. Well, how do you ignore a migrant and refugee story? How do you see someone risk their lives and then go, I don't know, it's kind of suspicious? How do you do that? I don't even understand.
You got to be white to do it, I think.
I mean, at least. I mean, we've got in our city right now, we've got migrant youth down at the Freedman Coliseum, and I'm proud of our city. Proud of our city because it wasn't forced upon us. We offered it.
Right.
We offered it to say, we have this space, bring them here. We will do this. You know what I mean? So I think I'm really proud of our city for trying to help. And it is a problem. The problem is not just we have too many kids. The problem isn't just that we don't have a great policy for handling that many kids. The problem is, why is there such atrocities being perpetrated in areas that there are that many kids that women and mothers and families are risking sending across the river? Every migrant child in the Freedman Coliseum was just like baby Nicole.
Yeah.
Handed off by someone to someone and just praying, God protect them and get them there. Because with or without their family, it was a better chance that they would live sending him there than it was to stay at home.
I can't even imagine.
This is like mind blowing to me. I just can't.
No, I can't either. June has that little conversation with Mrs. McKenzie and they talk about Hannah/Agnes. Hannah was her name before. Agnes is what they call her in Gilead. And how she wants a dog but won't commit to the shots, which I thought was so, like, it was so sweet in how well both of these women knew this child.
Yeah.
But it made me think about hypoallergenic dogs and what some of the options might be.
Yes.
So the American Kennel Club says no dog is 100% hypoallergenic.
Right, right. We know.
Which,
we know.
Yeah, you know, people forget that.
I guess people
and they
do.
And they mentioned a poodle mix. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, the golden doodle.
Yeah. But Afghan hounds are also considered hypoallergenic.
No.
But they're huge.
I love them.
I love them too, but they have to be bathed and brushed twice a week.
And that's a little much.
I'm like, I think if you bathed and brushed any dog twice a week, they'd probably end up close to hypoallergenic.
I mean, you would think. Although if you can train them to just walk in the shower and sit down with you, wash my hair, wash your hair.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's right.
Why not?
All your hairless breeds would be, yeah. So, you know, I have a friend who has a hairless cat, calls it Meatball. My kids think that's so gross, and I love it. I think it's hilarious. Bichon Frises.
Oh.
Again, they have hair, and they need grooming. So they're
very expensive.
They are expensive. All sizes of Schnauzer.
I learned that recently. I don't know why I learned that recently, but I was surprised, but not surprised, because the Schnauzer, that fur is more like hair.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Right. And well, and they tend to be like short all over the body, except for the the face and the feet. And then you give them the cute little beard. Oh, it's so cute.
Adorable.
So cute.
My cat is hypoallergenic.
Oh, yeah.
Bangle.
Yeah. So June is told at the re-education center that while the Waterfords may have forgiven her, that God requires penance.
Uh-huh.
And so I was like, what does it say in the Bible? So,
oh, Jackie's gonna zip right now.
Got questions, had a question asked, is penance mentioned in the Bible? And the actual word is only in two translations, the New Living Translation and the New American Bible, which is a Catholic version. But that most literal translations, more literal biblical translations, tend to use the word humble rather than penance. So you humble yourself before the Lord sorts of things. Penance is a sacrament in the Roman Catholic Church, and usually that takes the form of praying a certain prayer a specific number of times, or fasting, or kneeling in front of an altar for a certain amount of time, and that is more of an idea of, hey, reflect on what you've done and how you might be able to do better in the future. And it really just means to change your mind or attitude towards God and your behavior. It's not really a biblical. It's not punishment. It's not really a biblical thing.
No, not so much.
It's more of a theology-specific idea. Yeah. So theology is really the study of man's understanding of God, not necessarily what God actually wants for people. So it's all up to interpretation. It's this whole thing.
Yeah.
So June's penance
is
foot whipping.
Yeah, that's awful.
Yeah, she's been through this before.
Yeah, she has.
So she kind of knows what's coming. It's also called bastinado. Yeah. And it really refers to the caning of the sole, and it's between the heel and the balls of the feet.
Ow.
Because it hurts more, but it doesn't cripple you. It's really more of a embarrassment and punishment. It's not meant to really cripple anyone for permanently.
Okay.
It will cripple them for a time, but it's really old. Bastinado has written documentation in Europe dating back to 1537, but in China back to 960 AD. Yeah.
I felt like this was something that came out of medieval Europe.
I mean, it feels like it.
Apparently it didn't, but I can see them using it.
Yeah. And it typically happens in prisons, which I would argue that's exactly what the Red Center is.
It's
a prison, corporal punishment. It was also carried out by the Third Reich
in
Germany.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. Anyway, I saw a couple places where they said, oh, well, you know, bastinado or foot whipping, foot caning it's in the Bible. Not really.
Okay.
Like the three that they listed were Proverbs 22:15, Leviticus 9:20. Leviticus and I have issues, and Deuteronomy 22:18, but really they talk about punishment, but not
like a commandment either. It's like a description of things that were occurring such that.
Yeah. Taken out of context.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine that. Something from the Bible taken out of context. What?
Mm. Where are my pearls?
All of the sources that we use to inform our discussion here on Killer Fun Podcast can be found on our social media. Join us on Facebook at Killer Fun Podcast, exploring the intersection of crime and entertainment. You can find us on Twitter at Killer Fun Pod, or you can send us an email at killerfunpodcast@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to share a link to whatever information you're looking for. We love to hear from you. You might learn a little something too. All right, so psychology break. All right, so, man, Serena is suffering the loss of this baby.
Yes, she is.
She is suffering so much. So Jade Wu, Dr. Jade Wu, wrote an article for Psychology Today called Pain is Unavoidable, Suffering is an Option. It's interesting that there's a distinction that pain is relatively simple. It's an unpleasant physical sensation in many cases. It could be something that happens to you emotionally, but it's universal and unavoidable. You're going to have some pain at some point, and it's useful to us as humans. It is
very useful.
Helps us to, you know, learn to not touch the hot stove or not to trust that person. And that, you know, emotional pain actually is similar. It helps us to have empathy, to console people around mm-hmm. us. We can understand what they're going through. Suffering's messier, and it comes more when we don't acknowledge the source of the pain and deal with it so much. That here's what she says. This is what sets pain and suffering apart. Pain simply is. Suffering cannot sit still. Suffering wrestles with the pain, trying to deny it or bargain with it or judge it or blame it on someone, projecting onto the future, regretting it from the past. Suffering becomes the center of your experience. So we tend to suffer when we don't take ownership of it. We don't acknowledge where it's coming from. But when we try and blame it on somebody else, or try and, or when we think we're never going to be free of it, which may be true, but it's more of an attitudinal sort of situation.
Oh,
do you not agree?
No.
You got that look like you don't agree.
I'm trying to soak it in, but I don't like her operationalized definition of suffering.
Okay.
Because everything she just described is really, really a consensus is on this. That's grief.
Okay.
Grief is unavoidable.
Okay.
If your child dies,
mm-hmm.
it's not arbitrary pain. The arbitrary pain exists, but to act like it's just a choice whether you suffer or grieve after your child dies is not. That's just as inauthentic.
Mm.
You will go through the stages of grief. You have to. And part of the grief is acknowledging the loss. You can't, and you'll go through the denial and you'll go through all of that kind of stuff. So I guess when I was waiting for her definition of suffering, but that definition that she gave that sets pain apart from suffering is really grief.
Mm.
And so
I think it's the, when it's beyond grief, because she says how to let go of suffering. And there's some three different
okay.
suggestions. Let go of the idea that you can rid yourself of any experience that you've had. You can't really rid yourself with it, but you can deal with it. Fully experience the pain and sit with it non-judgmentally.
Mm-hmm.
And recognize the stories that your mind tells you about the pain. That if you center the pain as your identity, that's when you suffer.
I guess I would need to better understand what she means by suffering. Mm. Cause I don't, it doesn't sit well.
Okay.
I don't feel good about that at all.
Okay. Well,
I feel like it's like telling somebody they have a choice to be happy or unhappy.
Mm.
I feel like it's very invalidating.
Okay.
To tell somebody that their suffering is their choice is to blame the victim. Is to say that it's your fault you're suffering. The pain, your child dying, you losing a leg in war, all of these things, those just are arbitrary things that happened. And the fact that you're really messed up about it is really your choice.
Mm.
I don't like it.
Okay.
Now, all the three steps, she says, are good things to do to deal with the pain. But in the course of that, you will be grieving. You do have a suffering. At some point, your pain really is the center of your identity for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
If you're really going to sit down and look at your pain, that is actually putting it in the center. So
right.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways. That's cake and eat it too.
Right.
If you're going to deal with your pain, you have to recognize how important it is to you. And if it's really that important to you that you have to stop and be mindful about it, you have then just done what she said you can't do. And now you've put it in the center,
huh.
even for a short time. So I think it's healthy to put it in the center for a short time. I think it's, like she said, actually, I think it is good to acknowledge it. But those are stages of grief. And to say that you wouldn't suffer and that suffering is bad. Mm. First of all, her underlying premise is that suffering is bad.
Okay.
And suffering is an option. You don't have to suffer. Okay. Tell that to, I don't know, slaves.
Yeah, that's
Tell fair. That to Rosa Parks. Tell that to Martin Luther King Jr. Tell me that their suffering wasn't really in a way that they would call it an option.
Hmm.
And that they wouldn't also say it's painful and good.
Yeah.
Because it will be used for good.
Okay.
Right? So I think she has a, I don't know. I don't like how she's coming at it.
She's maybe not entirely wrong, but maybe her, maybe the choice of the word suffering is inaccurate.
Yeah, I don't know what is an option after pain. I mean, okay, pain is unavoidable, but being an awful human being is an option.
Oh, well, there you go.
Losing credibility and character and things like integrity is an option. Okay.
Wow.
I don't know what
Jackie's
I don't know.
Coming after Dr. Wu.
I feel a lot of denial in that.
Okay.
To say that pain is arbitrary. This is actually a very common occurrence in psychology. So let me just digress a little bit with this. It is a common occurrence for people to fall on one side or the other and not to examine the qualitative experience. And so you have a lot of people who are looking at psychological phenomenon from a very medical-only perspective, from a very cognitive perspective, as in just habits, things that you form, change your thinking, all of these things. Like you said, they're not wrong, but they tend to ignore qualitative data. They tend to ignore, and I say tend because it's just kind of like, it's one of those industry fights. Understand that. Not individuals are ignoring this. I'm just saying, like, you know, it tends to be the big fight between, you know, the different disciplines is that the conscious qualitative experience is often left in the dust. And so I think to act like suffering is an option is a very cognitive approach.
Okay.
It's very like, oh, you are suffering, then let's do these few things. And then when you do 1, 2, and 3, you will have retrained your synapses and you will have rid yourself of suffering.
Mm.
Now, I don't know, did you learn anything from that suffering? Did you come out of it? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. So I fall a little on the other side.
Okay.
Where I'm all about the cognitive is very useful, very applicable to many, many things. But when you're talking about something that is the conscious experience of man, I think there has to be an integrative approach between how you deal with it medically, cognitively, and mindful.
Okay.
And experiential. Okay. So that's why I really like, she and I would be like on different sides of the debate on many, many issues. I am certain of it.
Okay.
But that's my issue with it.
Yeah.
That's okay. My issue with it.
Maybe I just didn't have a lot of sympathy for Serena Joy's suffering in this way. I'm like, June only bore, quote unquote, your baby because you had her raped.
She is suffering because of the loss of Nicole, but that's not why she's suffering. It didn't start with Nicole.
No.
She has been grieving the loss of the ability to bear her own child. And that's what drove her to this entire narrow objective to change the entire course of a nation and a people. Because she took it out on the world that she was one of the ones who couldn't have a child.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she's losing.
Right.
And now she's lost her last option to try to make up for her very huge deficit. The thing that she centers. She's not centering the pain of losing Nicole. She is centering her ideal, or she's refusing to center her ideal and recognize that her identity is wrapped up in whether or not she can bear children.
Right. Which we know she can't because We saw a flashback where she was shot.
Right. So, I mean, I feel, and that was a traumatic event. She has flat out PTSD over this. And now all of that, this is where I say it's not okay to then become a bad person, lose your integrity and everything. It's not okay to take it out on everyone else. And that's what she did. But could she have ever avoided suffering when she was shot in the womb?
Right. That's fair.
she's suffering and she feels like Nicole was taken away from her, and she was, but she actually gave her up.
Right.
It's not at all like June.
No.
June
no.
literally had her child ripped from her.
Right.
Serena Joy actually finally made the mother's choice.
Right.
And she's suffering for it and really recognizing what it's like to actually be a mother. And now, so I don't think she can avoid suffering.
Mm. Now, okay.
Whether we have empathy for her process or not is totally different. But what you hope is that by suffering, that her suffering that may or may not be deserved or whatever is a whole other ethical issue, but that her suffering causes her to maybe be a better person.
Okay.
Her grief. Yeah. And that's why I'm like, this suffering grief thing, the way that the author put it, Dr. Wu is putting suffering and grief together and not really operationalizing these words.
Right.
It seems like, I don't know, a really quick blog post.
Okay. Well, maybe that's all it was.
Sorry. All right. No, I digress. That's fine. I shut up now.
All right. Real life.
Real life.
All right. So Commander Lawrence first calls June spunky.
Spunky. I love it.
So, which is really funny because in American English, it means gumption.
Mm-hmm.
In British English, it means semen.
What?
Have you not heard of?
No.
Spunk as ejaculate?
No, I have not.
Yeah.
So, well, I'll never unhear it now.
It comes from a Scottish term that predates the semen analogy and means spirit, courageous, meddlesome.
Okay. Yeah. So the British are the ones that made it a slang term.
Yeah. Well, you know, whatever. Yeah.
I love the way that that Lawrence says it. That Commander Lawrence says it. Spunky. Like, he's such a like a character, you know.
He's such a character. And you want to like him. And then you realize he's the freaking architect of Gilead. And you want to smack him, too.
Yeah, but also that's a lot of guilt to leverage.
Oh, leverage she does. Yeah,
leverage she does.
So when June visits her sleeping Hannah, she ties a red string around her wrist.
Yes.
Now, you could argue that this is the only thing that she had, string from her cloak to tie around Hannah's wrist. But it actually has some kind of interesting backstories. Mm-hmm. So Pink Mango is a site that sells lots of things, but red string bracelets as well, but they have some history of where it comes from. There are many different cultures and beliefs that have red string as part of their belief system, which is kind of interesting. So there's the Kabbalah, which I think we all maybe remember this. We would see the red string bracelets on that Madonna wore when she was studying Kabbalah, and it's a mystical form of Judaism, and it's used for protection and luck. But it's also from Hinduism, which kind of means protection or faith or a blessed marriage, depending on what region you're in. Chinese culture has the red string of fate that ties together the lives of everyone and is usually associated with marriage. But in Latin America, red string bracelets are often put on newborn infants to protect them.
Oh.
And even the Christian Bible mentions it in Genesis. There's a mention of a scarlet string being tied around the wrists of twin infants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
So it's just kind of interesting that there's a lot more. It seems symbolism. Like a little thing, and this is all she had, but it maybe had a little bit more meaning behind it, which is kind of interesting.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. So Commander Waterford tells lies.
Yes, he does.
He tells some pretty significant lies. He does it to protect Serena Joy, ends up protecting June in the absence of baby Nicole. They have to explain it somehow. And of course, that would be illegal in Gilead.
Oh, yeah.
As would that sort of lie be illegal in the U.S. and most places in the world. But there are a lot of lies that aren't currently illegal that a article in the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology from 2011, so it's a little old, suggests maybe there should be some lines that should be illegal.
Okay. Oh, gosh. I got to reset. Hold on.
Yeah.
Time to listen. This is interesting. All right. All right. All right. Hit me with this.
So they start out by saying...
Wait. Hold on. You surprise me often, but I didn't even know this was a subject. Continue.
Oh, okay. Well, good.
Yeah, I'm like, what? I mean, okay, yeah, what?
Yeah,
I'm like, there's a whole new thing to think about. Yeah. Okay.
So they acknowledge that some people might say you don't want to over-criminalize things because that leads to oppression.
Right.
Got it. Okay.
We're there.
But they're saying that there should be a new category of crime, which is egregious lying causing serious harm.
Oh!
Not currently a thing. So they have this whole example where your neighbor comes over and tells you that your kid has been hit by a car, and you freak out and you go running outside and, you know, they point and laugh. And that's like really horrific. Or they do it to... extort money. Now that would fall under breaking the law, under extortion, but not the lie.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah. And they're saying we're not talking about societal things. Friends lie to friends to be polite. Friends lie to their professors about missed assignments. Husbands lie to their wives about their whereabouts when in fact they're having affairs. Teenagers lie to their parents about the friends they keep. We even lie that we feel fine when we do not. Our relatives lie, our coworkers lie, and we lie to them. This article does not assert that all lies should be criminalized. Rather, it proposes that certain lies in certain circumstances should be made criminal. Lies that are explicitly intended to cause uniquely serious harm and where harm results. And they go on to talk about how lying is already criminalized in many contexts. Forgery, face waltz and measures, defamation, you know, where you lie under oath, you know, you mischaracterize things. And just, I just thought it was such an interesting
that they might thought
that there was, you know, there are lies that you can tell that aren't criminal, but maybe ought to be.
That's so interesting.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to be thinking about that.
I know.
That's
because
interesting.
It's, you know, there seems like there's so much gray area in it, but it also seems like there's certain lies that you're like, you shouldn't be able to say that.
Okay. I can think of a situation where if the lie had been criminalized, action could have been taken before far more egregious acts occurred.
Okay.
Because this person who is an absolute charlatan and just stealing money through being a con man, mm-hmm. right? Which is that is not okay. However, it's not against the law for this person to have given money to the con man because none of that could be taken care of. The police couldn't do anything about the fact that this guy was lying about all of these other things and then taking her money.
Uh-huh.
Now, on the whole, he's a con man and then he left. Now we can say that he's a con man because he stole the money, but all the lies and all the ways that she like literally freely gave it in the middle, there's nothing they could be done. But when he up and absconds and gets away, this, that, and the other.
Right. So if the lie could have been criminal,
then we called the cops earlier, they would have said, that's a con man. We'll take care of that.
That's right.
Maybe that would have prevented, or he would have been criminally charged. And so she wouldn't have to think about, I can't afford a civil lawsuit.
Right.
Because if the state would prosecute it, then maybe she could get some of the money back too.
Right. Ooh.
So I could see that.
Yeah.
But then I could so easily see it causing such a problem for people who legitimately are dating and then break up, right? And then you get to say, well, that was a con man situation. No, it wasn't. No. You were legitimately dating and you spent money and now you broke up. So I could see how hard that would be.
But it's so interesting.
Ah, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So lying about what happened to a child like the Waterfords did, not uncommon.
Oh. That's awful.
I know. January of 2019, ABC7 in Newark reports woman fabricates attempted kidnapping story to Long Island police to cover up how baby was injured. So the baby was one and in a stroller and not secured, and the baby fell and got hurt. And rather than saying, I made a mistake and the baby got hurt, they said that somebody tried to kidnap the baby and that's how the baby got hurt. Because they were trying to stay out of trouble. And instead they got themselves in more trouble.
More trouble.
Which is stupid. You know, that seems fairly benign. I mean, the baby got hurt, but the baby didn't die.
Yeah.
But sometimes people cover up more nefarious sort of situation that really shouldn't have been that bad. But because they lied about it, it became that bad. And I'm thinking of a particular one that happened here in San Antonio, which was baby King Jay. And he went missing and they staged a whole abduction scene at a gas station so that it would be caught on the surveillance at the gas station. The baby was already dead when they staged that. They wanted it to look like a kidnapping so that they wouldn't get in trouble for it. Really, this man was playing video games and the baby fell and hit their head and died a few hours later. But because he didn't get the baby help immediately right after the baby hit their head, and then the baby subsequently died.
He would have gone to jail.
Right. He might have gone to jail, but if he picked up the baby or called 911 and said there's been an accident, probably it would have been fine.
Yeah, but not if he did it later.
But yeah, exactly. Not if he did it later, but because he was just like, oh, you're fine, and put the baby to bed or whatever, and the baby died, they covered it up. And oh gosh, I remember when that was happening, it was horrific.
Oh, there are a lot of stories about that, especially shaken baby syndrome and things of that sort. Because yeah, you can be criminally charged when it is easy to make that call wrong. When they're crying and they're fine and you're like, okay, I think everything's all right. And then they die.
Yeah.
And then, but our system is not exactly, doesn't have enough grace to investigate that without. And yet on the other hand, should he be charged? Oh, ethics.
Ugh. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of nuance there.
There's a lot of nuance.
Well, yeah. And you know, he was home playing video games. Maybe he was also stoned and, you know, or whatever. There's extenuating circumstances which made them not want to call the police in. So Serena burning down the couple's bed.
Oh, yeah.
May have been loosely based on something real.
Ooh.
On the case of Francine Hughes.
Interesting.
So she was a woman who set fire to the bed that her ex-husband was sleeping in because he'd been abusing her.
Okay.
So they were married, and he was terrible to her while they were married, and they got divorced in April of 1971. But then he had a very serious car accident right after their divorce was finalized, and she let him move back into the house because she felt bad for him, because who else is going to take care of such a horrible, horrible man?
Mm-hmm.
And so he got to continue abusing her, even though they were no longer married. So she did, like, she was so close to getting out. So close. And he beat her, destroyed furniture. He murdered his daughter's kitten.
One point.
I mean,
that's a triad alert.
This man has some very serious and terrible issues.
Mm-hmm.
And she was really worried that if she kicked him out, he was going to make good on his threats to harm her and her children. Yeah. So
set a little fire, did she?
Yeah. So she decided that she couldn't risk that. So she bundled up her kids and put them in the car and set fire to the bed he was asleep on. This was 13 years from the beginning of their marriage to when she did this.
Okay.
So it was 1977. So like 6 years after she was no longer married to the guy and she should have been free. And she still wasn't free of this man. And at trial, she was found not guilty because she was the first to have temporary insanity due to battered women syndrome as her defense. Oh,
this is the first. This is the first.
So I was like, well, Serena Joy isn't battered mostly. I mean, she had her finger cut off.
She is emotionally battered.
But she's definitely abused.
Oh, definitely.
She abuses, but she is also herself a victim. Mm-hmm. It's so complicated.
And she was gonna let herself die.
Yeah.
June saved her.
June saved
her. This was a suicide attempt.
Yeah.
Burn it all down. I'm going down too.
Right.
Like, I'm done.
Yeah. She lights the bed on fire because that's really the heart of this, is that she's been betrayed by her husband.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, she feels like. So it's a symbolic sort of burning.
And now the baby's gone.
And the baby's gone, and there's no really hope of another, because what is June going to bear her another child and let her keep that one?
June and Nick going to do it because it's not her husband's either.
No,
So, I mean, what is she? She just, it was a suicide attempt. And then June saves her.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting choice. Yep. I was proud of her. That's what makes her a hero to me.
Well, exactly.
Because this was her way out.
Right.
Let it burn.
Let it burn.
Right? Like, she could have been like, problem solved.
Uh-huh. Well, had she not saved Serena, she might have been blamed for it.
She might have been. She might have been. But if she had barely gotten out like she did, it would have been clear that she was escaping the fire. So, I don't know. She could have taken the chance and let Serena Joy go.
Right.
But she didn't. She saved her.
Right. So interesting. All right. Yeah. So next time, we're going to watch the first episode of season 4 called Pigs.
I
can't wait either. I'm so excited. I hope that there's enough crimey stuff to talk about, but I'm sure there'll be plenty of...
Well, they live in a crimey world, so...
I mean, really, like... Well, I mean, how do we leave... Spoiler alert. How do we leave the end of season 3?
Oh, yeah.
The Waterfords arrested for crimes against humanity, hoping to not be extradited to somewhere that will treat them really badly, other than Canada, because they know Canada probably won't kill them.
Right, exactly. Man, it was just such a good ending.
Oh,
I can't wait.
So good. All right, so that's what we're going to do next time. Until then, be safe, be kind, and wash your hands. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum. Da, 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 da.